This is a 3CR podcast.
And this is Published or Not.
We've got a busy day today. Jan, there's a whole mountain range running through this studio if we allow ourselves to indulge in the conceit running through Claire Thomas's novel On Not Climbing Mountains. So Claire, welcome back to 3CR.
Thank you for having me.
Literature is geological, if we go by this book. In the first section of the novel, we're simultaneously in Switzerland and also then affected by the eruption of Mount Tambora in Indonesia in 1815. How do those two things fit together?
Well, there was global mayhem after that eruption that wasn't understood for many years. All sorts of climate consequences, ecological disasters. And in Europe, perhaps one of the most well-known consequences is this year without summer, where, pretty self-explanatory, the weather was incredibly gloomy. And one of the most famous stories was Mary Shelley starting to write her novel Frankenstein in Switzerland. So that's the literal sort of connection there.
But what you've got there is this sort of metaphor of this permeance of the dust of the volcano going right around the earth, but then it's equated with the effect of literature having the same impact.
Yeah, I'm interested in the sort of dispersal of impact and the scale of consequences. So the tiny particle and the expansive mountain range, the canonical text and the little sort of seemingly inconsequential art moment, you know, all of that stuff and how they interconnect.
But it's a literary dust, if
yes,
I can put it that way, with
lovely,
a geological phenomenon, a metaphor for this vast dispersal that's going on. But Switzerland is then the centre of a lot of this story, but who are some of the authors then? I've lost count.
Yeah, so it was a very enjoyable process once I decided that I was going to encounter all these other writers. And there's a lot of big, obvious ones that are perhaps not in there on purpose. That's a bit of the not climbing mountains thing. So some obvious big white dudes are not in there. So there are people like James Baldwin, Teju Cole, Patricia Highsmith. There's Catherine Mansfield, yes.
Rilke, Remarque.
Yes.
All of these that have at some point had a connection.
Yeah, and there's also actual Swiss writers. So Fleur Jaeggi is one of my favourite Swiss writers, and another incredible woman from the early 20th century called Anne-Marie Schwarzenbach,
But it's like Switzerland is resonating,
yes,
with all of these authors at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
But with that global scale, yeah, we've also got a personal journey of the character in this story. She's on a tour of Switzerland and has a copy, I think 1891, was it? Baedeker's Switzerland guidebook. But the book is simultaneously contained, but expansive. When the book is closed and the pages form a thick solid block, waves of blue marbling appear on the three sides that are not on the spine, but it is the panorama that are the most beautiful component. They fold out beyond the margins. So simultaneously, again, you've got that same concept. Here's a single book, and yet and you describe that in detail, but then it expands.
Yes. Yes, that I love that you've picked that out and explained it in that way. Thank you. That is definitely one of my motivating kind of principles, I think, in writing this book, was that question of scale, which we've already touched on, but the way that something can expand and then contract, and how to navigate that quite literally as she's moving through the spaces, but also culturally, politically, emotionally, intellectually, all of those things, that kind of balance and, yeah, it's a lot to absorb or deflect, you know, all of those different things.
But what is your character doing in Switzerland?
Well, she is there because her father was born in Switzerland. That's one of the reasons why. So, and he's recently died. She's an Australian, and she's gone there. There's some sense of a desire to find him again, or because he was a reasonably reticent character, and he died suddenly, and she's got some level of regret about what she did and did not experience with him while he was alive. So there's some sense of trying to understand him, but also I think it becomes increasingly the case that she's trying to move beyond that father narrative, and so sort of beyond that traditional patriarchal journey story, and find her own way through the world.
Her father died in a very Australian fashion.
Yes, he was driving in rural Victoria. He was a school teacher on his way to teach at a camp, and he got hit by a large kangaroo. And so there's a sort of terrible irony about that.
But the other thing is, she's coming out of a class teaching Baldwin. So again, you've got this resonance, the father being a teacher and such like, literature still sort of resonating.
Hovering there. Over everything. Yeah, and that is the way she makes sense of the world and the way she's comforted by these connections. She's very solitary, and it might sound a little bit cheesy, but the books are her friends. They are her solace. They're her. She sees herself reflected and absorbed in those texts. Yeah,
but there's a life in them. They've got a life of their own in some ways.
And they're intimately dealt with, I hope, in the book. Yeah.
But here we go again. We've got an interconnectedness of location, an interconnectedness of literature, as well as that sort of personal journey of the character. Mm. But you actually go into then the very language. You talk of the novel Heidi. The German Heimweh translates as Heim, home, and Weh, woe, the longing for the absent home, understood in English as homesickness. But then Heimweh, and you go into the Greek origins then, of Nostos and Algos and such like. So we're going into the very words.
Yes, I get quite granular in, you know, the language. And I think that's partly because Switzerland is very linguistically interesting, and its literature is, you know, German or French or Italian, or, you know, it's quite, there's an inherent complexity to that. And she is an English teacher, a literature teacher, but she's fascinated with language, and these German compound words are very satisfying to kind of unpack. And the Heidi, the and Heimweh, I mean, that's just her sort of musing on a resonance.
Yeah, the sound permeates as well and carries and is evocative, just as the novel may touch you, just as having the physical book may be redolent of something else. Yeah. So there's another layer that I didn't quite get into as much, the artists painting waiting rooms.
Yes. So one of the, I guess, what became an organising principle in this novel is a series of paintings that I saw many years ago that just stayed with me. There are 92 of them, gorgeous little oil paintings of interior spaces that are waiting rooms, and they're emptied of people. They're quite simple, quite calm, and there was something that captivated me about these paintings. And once I realised I was starting to write a novel about Switzerland, I sort of went back into these paintings, and I realised they were all train station waiting rooms in various villages around Switzerland. And I did a residency in the course of writing this, and which was at a cultural foundation in a little village in Switzerland. And it was only when I was there that I realised that the village, that this residency was located in the final village like in the painting series. It was just this crazy kind of serendipitous discovery because there's not much else there. And so these paintings, there's a sense of the literal waiting, the pause, but also the possibilities and the in-between and the insistence again on noticing the small and the perhaps peripheral and the interiority in a country that is so overdetermined in terms of the scale of its landscape. But so that kind of play again.
There's also a sense of threat, the Gotthard Tunnel.
Yeah.
And how you describe that, would you like to go into?
Look, that's a monumental project of in the 19th century in Switzerland, this huge tunnel that went straight through the middle of the country, really. The way that the land was penetrated, you know, all of those kind of connotations, and it was violent and ecological and environmental consequences of that process was amazing. And then there was a very important strike amongst the workers on the Gotthard Tunnel, which I found really interesting and was something I wanted to include. And just, again, getting into the complexities of something that's just like a cool feat of engineering, but really what
people
what
died
was it?
And yeah, the diseases and everything.
Yes, it was a grim sort of process.
This sort of brings us round circle because we actually end up in Australia in a cave looking at moths, believe it
yes,
or not.
The Bogon moth.
The Bogon
yes.
moth. And the character's with her father.
Yep.
But the moths on the wall are like the shingles or yeah. tiles on a Swiss chalet. I do not know if I remember the moths this way because my father made the connection when we were together in the cave. So there's a sort of, okay, how do we interpret this, the memory, the recollection, the threat of the cave or the tunnel in the past?
Mm.
But it leads then to a sort of description of your structure, if I could put it this way. It's another circular looping memory or knowing within me or beyond me, one that does not have a definite starting point or direction. And in some ways that sums up the novel because I was looking for a structure, but it's sort of amorphous. It works, it comes together, but it's the resonating, the interconnectedness. I don't know how else to describe it.
No, I love that you pulled out that little those phrases there, because I think you're absolutely right. That's that again, it's what it says on the cover on not climbing. So I was resisting that traditional narrative, you know, climax, reaching the peak for and being more circular. And so that was the form reflects a lot of the themes as well in that way. And bit that you just said that she doesn't even know where this knowledge has come from, and is there a precise moment of origin, or you know, how do you determine that, and does it matter? And even with travel, it's not always clear whether she's been to these places in person or whether she's been to these places through her reading of the literature from these places or from the memories that her father has told her about these places. So I didn't want to ascribe the normal hierarchies to those sorts of experience. Yeah. I wanted to have all of it working together.
But what it's saying is our lives aren't linear in that regard. We like to impose a structure.
We like to think they might be. But
we teach a structure, but it's this combination and collection of experiences and oddments and fragments.
Yes.
We are going to have to stop there. We've only just begun because there's a spiritual journey in there with a bottle in the lake and Marlene Dietrich. And there's so much more. But the novel is On Not Climbing Mountains, the author Claire Thomas, and it's a Hachette release, Jan.
Sounds fascinating. Now, everybody hopes that their debut novel is a success, and wouldn't it be fantastic if it was picked up and made into a movie? And here's hoping that happens to this morning's author, Bridie Blake, and her book, The Boyfriend Clause. Welcome, Bridie.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
This writing success did happen to your character, Adam Whittaker. Tell us a bit about him.
Adam is a joy. So Adam, I've got a very soft spot for him. He is He can come across as a little bit prickly, but I think once you get to know him, you sort of know that he's actually just an introvert, and he does take a little while to warm up to people. And so the poor thing has Sabrina crash into his life and sort of upend everything, and he's a little taken aback by it. So it is probably why he comes off as a bit standoffish with her in the beginning.
Oh,
I think he handled it quite well. It's personally how I would probably handle it. She is a force.
He's just moving into Melbourne, right. And he's had the success. He's got a bit of writer's block on the sequel to this successful novel. He's in the elevator with boxes of moving in stuff, and he hears, "Hold the elevator." So tell us a little bit about Sabrina.
Sabrina is a force. So we meet Sabrina as she's running for her life. Quite literally, she has a little bout of food poisoning and is desperate to get to her apartment. She basically runs through the lobby, meets Adam, and it's off we go. But she's just somebody. She's just trying to make it in the world and not always successful at doing so.
She realises they get off at the same floor.
Yes.
So she makes, when she recovers, she makes him an apology cake, and she knocks on his door to deliver it and has a bit of a look around his apartment. And we're going to hear from Bridie Blake.
Glancing around, I search for something we might have in common, a mixer on his countertop or a rom-com among the stack of books on his white console table. I point at the stack. "Do you have three copies of the same book? Are you a collector or something?" "The Sleeping Bones," I read from the spine. Oh, that book was so overhyped. My dad and sister were obsessed with it and made me read it, and ugh, it was awful. "Did you hear there's going to be a sequel, even though everything was wrapped up, so I have no idea why they even need one, and they're turning it into a movie?" I roll my eyes. 2 hours of watching a guy mope and be moody while he solves a crime? No, thank you. He stares at me.
Of course, that's his book.
That is his book. She does not know that yet.
But the apology cake, it's her baking skills. They're very good.
Mm-hmm.
And she's just opened a cafe with her best friend, Hattie. Why is she so constantly annoyed by Adam's visits?
Oh, he doesn't buy anything. He sits there and he drinks his cup of coffee and takes up space, valuable space, I should say. If you're a cafe owner and you're trying to make money, you want people coming in and spending money, and he's just there drinking his coffee and doing nothing else.
Sabrina's family, the Fogarty family, is close, especially after Diane, the mother, is in remission for cancer. Life is short. That's why Sabrina moved away from her corporate job, and her parents have put the money into this cafe business. But there's a clause.
There is.
What's the clause?
So the clause is, Sabrina will complete a business course and be in a committed relationship or in a relationship headed towards commitment 2 years from the signing of this contract.
And that's why the title is the boyfriend clause.
That's right.
So the mother, Diane, she's set Sabrina up with lots of blind dates.
Mm-hmm.
She goes on these blind dates because she's been Diane.
Correct. Yes. She's been Diane. So Diane, it's basically Diane's world, and they're all living in it. And what Diane wants, Diane gets. She's very persistent. She knows how to tug at those heartstrings. She loves a guilt trip. And so she's been forcing Sabrina into all these awful blind dates that she's finding for her.
Many toxic relationships later, and when her mother asks about her current boyfriend, Sabrina thinks of the first name that comes to mind.
Adam Whittaker.
Hattie, who the friend who is in the cafe, also watches Adam sitting in the cafe. "Your fake boyfriend is a hottie."
Mm-hmm. Oh, he is. He is.
And how can you dump a fake boyfriend?
You can't.
Now, this comes back to Diane and her sister Carol. What have they won?
So they win a holiday over to the UK to tour the sites of their favourite TV show, Clovedale. They are obsessed with it. They force the entire family to watch it. And it's, their dream trip.
And this is for the entire family. Mm-hmm. Sabrina's sister and her partner and kids, as well as her auntie, uncle, cousin, and even his girlfriend. So it's assumed Adam will join them. He gets Diane.
Absolutely. The poor thing gets Diane a lot in this book. But yeah, it starts with him being Diane into joining the trip.
He does go because something Sabrina promises him, and it's not sex. No. Let's hear a little bit more from the boyfriend clause, page 62.
Pretend we can tolerate one another. I don't dare say that we will need to do more than that because, again, I don't want to cause a scene. But surely he knows that this will be nothing like the dinner with my parents. We're going to have to hold hands and hug and, oh God, kiss. I'm an affectionate person. In addition to food, physical touch is my love language. My family knows that, and this man can't even touch my arms for more than 2 seconds. This is going to unravel fast. You can't come, I blurt out, panic lacing my words. We're in the air, Sabrina, and neither one of us has the power to order a plane to turn around.
So here they are in England, the whole family staying in a multi-roomed manor house, but they are given the cottage, one bed. Tensions of this, especially as Adam thinks he will be writing all day with the second book deadline coming up, but they're gone because he gets Diana'd.
Absolutely. The poor thing has to attend every excursion.
You give us some detail about family members. Sabrina's got an older sister, Gabby.
Yep, we do. So Gabby's little miss successful. She is a lawyer. She is absolutely killing it in her career. She's happily married. She's got two kids. And she's not overly nice to Sabrina.
Yeah.
I feel like her favourite pastime is to pick apart Sabrina's life and to do it in front of everyone.
Along with Cousin Tommy.
Cousin Tommy, yes.
Well, he's a radio broadcaster and they both like to pick on Sabrina.
They do. They love it. It brings them joy.
But Cousin Tommy has a girlfriend, Natalie.
Yes. So she is an influencer. Look, I really like her. I think people might think that she's there just purely for the photo opportunity. She's cozying up to Adam because he's Adam Whitaker. He's a best-selling author. He's famous. But deep down, she really does have a heart of gold. And that does come through, I think.
I like that, you know, she's done so much. She studied creative writing. She studied journalism. Yes. She's beautiful. And she also is a very good runner. So she's out early morning running with Adam.
She does it all. And she's got incredible hair.
Oh, yes. And she takes a photo of hunky Adam and Sabrina and posts about their cafe.
Mm-hmm.
And now Hattie, back in Melbourne, reports it's the best turnover they've ever had in the cafe.
Yeah.
But it's not her baking.
Oh, no, it's not even her win. That was like soul-crushing to write. It's like the poor thing has been trying so hard and it's a social media post that gets people in the door.
Sabrina's dad, he's got this absolute love of botany, all the trees and leaves, and he can't pass one without noticing it. Mm-hmm. But it's Uncle Max. Oh, what a gem Uncle Max is with his weird facts.
His weird, useless facts. So I had a job where, as part of my job, I sent out a daily useless fact to the team. And so that was when I created Uncle Max. I was like, oh, my God, he's going to be a useless fact man. It just seemed to fit him so perfectly.
How many birds would landing on the hand of Big Ben weigh?
Yeah.
Look, that was just ridiculous.
Yeah. It depends on the type of bird, obviously, as well. So it becomes a conversation. And, yes, it's a family task.
Now, we mentioned about Gabby and Tommy constantly teasing, talking down to me, making me the butt of jokes because it's always been that way and I don't know how to stop it.
Yeah.
We're not a family who talks through issues. We skirt around them, pretend everything is okay and continue on like it's normal.
Yes.
Sounds like quite a lot of families. But then there's the games.
Yeah.
They are so competitive.
Yes. So that is pulled from my own family. We are the most competitive bunch of people you will ever meet.
Adam has a journal. He continually writes in it. He says he's not spying, just being observant, and can tell Sabrina many things about herself.
Mm-hmm.
Should she read it?
Yeah, I don't know. Would you?
And what Sabrina's noticed about him, he occasionally has a furrowed brow, which looks like he's solving a complicated puzzle.
Yes.
Yes, indeed. He is constantly trying to solve that puzzle.
We started with Adam's book success. He's given the Fogarty Farm a review copy of his next book to read. Mm-hmm. Sabrina's comment, oh, there's a lot of rom-coms. Do a little jump so we can see where the couple is 6 months down the road. Well, what can we tell about this couple? Nothing.
Nothing.
Absolutely nothing.
Bridie Blake has written about the chaos and joy of a big family life, the overlapping conversations, the competitiveness, the laughter, especially in suppressed desire and mouth-watering cakes in the boyfriend clause. Thank you, Bride.
And thank you, Jan. You know, Jan, I don't think I'm going to be quite as upset as I usually get for not cleaning my house, because all of the dust lying around could be just literary dust.
Oh, the remnant dust.
It might have a resonance of some kind, a fragment from Switzerland carrying one of the characters, at least, in Claire Thomas's novel. I forgot to mention Charlie Chaplin as well. He gets into here. Marlene Dietrich is there because she had a relationship with Erich Maria Remarque, who wrote All Quiet on the Western Front. There was a spiritual journey where Eric threw a bottle into the lake. Claire, what happened there?
Yeah, into a Swiss lake where he lived, and it was there, and he wrote about it in his diaries, and some crazy fans decided they would want to come and see if they could salvage it. It's a beautiful little episode, and it's quite...
How many years later?
Decades later.
Decades later, they find
And I learnt researching that little episode about the extraordinary depth of Swiss lakes. Like, I had no idea. They're like oceanically deep.
But the extraordinary depth of people's passion. Mm. Jan, we're going to have to get out of here.
I can tell you
Talk about passion.
In the cafe, they're going to have a little plaque that Adam Whittaker sat here and wrote his second sequel. Oh, yeah.
You've just been listening to Published or Not on 3CR.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.